This episode is brought to you by UiPath. Human achievement can be slow. 200,000 years to go from the wheel to your jalopy? Really? But today, 90% of the Fortune 500 are accelerating human achievement simply. When AI is everywhere, every process can be automated and accelerated. 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 UiPath, the AI everywhere foundation of innovation.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
The Sour Hour is meant for the serious brewer. The Sour Hour may contain some seriously funkified content. The Sour Hour is not for the faint of heart. So exercise some damn discretion, would you please? Sheesh. And now, here's the Sour Hour with Jay Goodwin.
All right, we are back again. Got Creature Comforts on the show. Got Blake on the line. It's Sour Hour. I'm your host, Jay. We're in Concord. You know that. Scott's here.
Hi.
Bevo's not. She's up in Portland. Join her tomorrow. Yes, tomorrow. So nothing's really up. Listen live on the app. I don't know how you'd hear that if you're not already doing it, but that's where we are.
Yep.
You can call in. We'll try to answer the phone. Email us, Scott at thebrewingnetwork.com, Jay at thebrewingnetwork.com, and subscribe, leave feedback,
question mark,
iTunes. Review of the week, we are good.
Yes, but you can please leave reviews, of course, for the show. It helps tremendously with climbing the charts, and thanks to everybody who's already done it, and if you haven't done it, please do.
Yeah, we have a lot of reviews, but, you know, we want more, and it helps people find us, and we will read them on the air. All right. I did shoot Blake a quick text during the break to tell him how much we're enjoying the beers so far. And he basically promised that the next beers we're drinking are even better,
yes.
Which is hard to imagine. But right now we've got Subtle Alchemy open in front of us. Blake, can you tell us a little bit about this one?
Yes. So do you have blend one? Or, I mean, sorry, do you have blend two or three open?
Two currently.
Okay. So the Subtle Alchemy is a series that we started up, I guess. I packaged that. Spent some time. I blended those and packaged the first three blends up in January of 2017. And the idea was to kind of take individual voices through our wood cellar and be able to create a unique composition by virtue of that blend that, for all intents and purposes, is not recreatable. Because we just kind of have these unique flavors, different barrels, things like that. And we're like, okay, you know, I'll blend them together. And this is just kind of the snapshot. So it's an ongoing series. Blend number two is unique for us in the sense that it focuses on American oak, which we don't really normally have in our mixed fermentation cellar. But that particular beer, two-thirds of it is aged in American oak. And then I brought in some French oak just to give it some balance. But after tasting a few of the different projects in the wood cellar, I kind of started developing this idea of flavor pattern between the different voices of kind of like cherries and cream was kind of the idea. So the oldest part of that is actually a grisette we make, usually all aged in stainless, but I threw it in American oak barrel on second use Balaton cherries for about 2 years. And then I blended in, we had a stray barrel full of Athena that was re-inoculated. That was American oak barrel from a local winery. And then the third one is actually Golden Door, that you guys just had after it was like in the French Oak for about 10 months. So blending those three together, it kind of brought together the idea of like a nice, subtle cherry quality, definitely some vanilla and American oak lusciousness. And it's just kind of, it's gotten to a point now where I think it's all kind of coming together and making it pretty succinct and nice.
Yeah, this is very good. When you do so many different small projects and find the need to blend them together, do you ever find your mixed culture getting to like a shelf life in the oak barrel at all? Like, so you're aging it out for a really long time. I think sometimes what can happen is you're trying to either, you know, extract more flavor from those second use cherries or the American or French oak. And while you're waiting for that extraction, do you ever find yourself having to say like, okay, this is like getting a little past prime, or what's your experience with that?
Yeah, 100%. I feel pretty confident with our cellar storage conditions and our mixed culture for 12 months. I don't expect a whole lot of loss during that time as far as what goes wrong. After that, it starts getting a little more hairy, and that certainly exponentially gets more and more as we go on. So we don't top up, and while I do have a humidifier fire running in our barrel room, it stays dry a lot because our AC is running constantly, because this our barrel room is 65 degrees even when it's 100 outside, so it runs a lot sometimes. So we'll see a fair amount of evaporation, and that loss will lead to acetic acid development and then ethyl acetate as well. And so we'll dump those barrels as that develops. I would guess in general for a project, if you talk like a 30 barrel project as it goes into wood, we'll see approximately 10% loss maybe, where it just, we're dumping it, it's not good. Maybe a little more from time to time depending on how long it ages.
Well, this is very good. This is totally free from any of those acetic acid or ethyl acetate concerns. What about the American versus French oak? You mentioned you don't incorporate that much American oak. What's the reasoning behind that, and why do you do it when you do it?
Generally speaking, I like French oak for it doesn't really want to call a whole lot of attention to itself after it's been used a little bit by a winery, which is nice. American oak has a very strong presence, and obviously we've got a bunch of whiskey barrels that are all American oak, but you know, we put a lot, most of the time that's going to have a stout or a barley wine or something like that in them. With our oak cellar, I've kind of gotten to the point now where I've started to lean in a new direction recently, I would say over the last year or so, where I'm getting most of my wine barrels from a friend's winery actually in North Georgia that uses all French oak, and I think they make good wines. They're called Yona Mountain Vineyards, and like Arcadiana we tasted on the last show was mostly aged in those barrels. And then the American oak is something I just don't seek out. And so, like, for example, with this beer, Subtle Alchemy Blend 2, we just kind of had a few that land in our laps where someone was like, hey, try this or take this. And it was from very early on in our brewery's lifetime. So we're like, yeah. And we just took them and kind of put in there what we had available to us. And those unique voices were actually made more out of, you know, necessity than design. But the design came in when I was like, man, I got all these little things popping around, I need to figure out what I can do with them. And then started coming up with the blends that I thought made them work. But even, you know, blending that beer, it's definitely got those second use cherries, but I think there is, when I put the blend in, there was a little bit of acetic acid in one of those components that blended down to the point where, you know, there's like a threshold, you know, at some point it tastes acetic, and at some point you just kind of get like a nice cherry kind of quality. And I thought it added to the cherryness, but then didn't present as acetic after the blend.
I would agree. This beer is nice and smooth, but the cherries do pop out a little bit, especially for being second use. You mentioned another one of the components is Athena that you had put into a barrel. How commonly are you, or how often are you guys doing that? And what's your goal when it's not just a one-off, or maybe it is just a one-off? What's your goal with putting Athena in the oak barrel?
Yeah, with that one, that was pretty much the only time we've ever done that. Like a few barrels showed up and it was like, hey, we got these, do you want them? And at that point in time, you know, we didn't have a whole lot of time to devote to the barrel program and where we're sourcing all of our stuff. It's like, yeah, absolutely, we'll take it. And then Athena was one of the few beers we had around that it made sense to throw into them. So that was kind of built out of necessity. And I think a lot of great things can come from you know, working with what's put in front of you and just figuring out how to make it work. And we do that a lot now, where I'm limiting like the fruit we use in this program. I'm really trying to lean on farmers that I can know and shake their hand. And sure, that means that we may not be able to put some other, you know, exotic fruit in there, but it means I can make a difference in a person's life and help a family plant some crops and sustain, you know, their what they're doing at their house. So I've started putting some lines in. There's like, these, you know, hold true to our values, and so we're going to continue to do it that way. And then where those are fixed, you know, I can have my variables be, you know, all over the place and adjust a few things at a time and kind of draw our house flavor by those things. Like, we're going to get Yona Mountain barrels, and we're going to use fruit from local farmers, and we're going to use our mixed culture. And then it kind of forces us to focus on other pieces to drive differentiation.
When you put Athena in the barrels, it was like acidified, basically finished Athena.
Yeah, yeah, it was just as you would have in a can sitting in the fermenter. And I was like, all right, well, let's just throw it into this barrel. If anything, it'll just be nice to put something in there that can wait until we find something better. But then we just kind of kept adding on.
What do you recommend for people who are, you know, trying your approach out, where you're wanting to work with local ingredients, local purveyors, local farmers? What are some of the practical challenges in that? Because I think a lot of people hear about that and, you know, that sounds good, but what are some of the challenges that come along with, you know, trying to be really local in the ingredients you're using?
Yeah, it certainly has a fair share of challenges, and we've just really started putting our foot down on that, you know, in the last 6 months or so. I'm fortunate where every Wednesday, like right now in our parking lot, we have a farmer's market going on. So I literally can walk out there and talk to the farmers that can supply us with strawberries, for example, or blueberries. And so what's tough is if you're going that route, like, for example, we got an insane amount of rain this year during our strawberry season. So I was looking to buy 1,000 pounds of strawberries, and I got 300 pounds of strawberries. So if you're trying to create a certain amount of volume, that gets very difficult. However, as I've started working with these guys, you know, 3 weeks after strawberry season, they're already buying the slats for next year's plants. And I said, you know what, commit me to next year buying 1,000 pounds from you guys. And they're like, all right, well, we'll get extra plants. And knowing that, you know, allows them to invest into their farm, because they're guaranteed to have some sort of buyout from us. And then how to handle those different varying sizes of fruit. You know, I've got a tank that can handle 1,000 pounds of strawberries, but handling 300 pounds was hard because there's a lot less volume. So I had to get kind of creative on what we were going to use to age that fruit in. And, you know, things just don't go always as planned. And you've got to be able to work with that. And luckily, we're at the point now where we're still building out this program, and we're able to plan for it and make sure that these variances aren't variances that are going to break the program, but are variances that will help the program thrive.
And when you think about the different fruits you guys have access to, what's, you know, on a pound per BBL basis, what's kind of the high end that you find yourself needing to use, maybe for the more subtle range of fruits? And what's kind of like the lower end for maybe a more intense fruit?
Oddly enough, most of the fruits around Georgia, I feel like, are pretty softly spoken fruits. So when we've used blueberries and peaches in the past, we're in the 4 to 5 pounds per gallon range to get an expression that we enjoy. And I think coming from that, we've gotten great peach expression. Blueberries still, I don't think, present like what all of us would think is blueberries, like a blueberry muffin, but I really enjoy the flavors they give off, and they become more like little grapes to a certain degree. And then we also source raspberries from a farmer, an organic farmer up in Virginia. Those, I think, are a lot louder in their presentation. So we'll be somewhere in the 1.5 to 2 pounds per gallon kind of range. And with all those, I certainly kind of follow along with taste, see where we're at, and then blend more beer in there if it seems that we're not getting enough of a diversification of flavor and it's just too overwhelming. But with a lot of these guys, like strawberries, blueberries, and peaches, are, I feel like, are pretty notorious for being not huge screamers.
Yeah, for sure. And what about when you get these different fruits in, how do you handle the processing? I mean, I imagine some of the berries are maybe a little bit easier, or maybe not, than like a peach.
Yeah, it certainly depends on how and when they're coming in. For strawberries, I wanted to be able to throw them all in just super fresh and ready to go. However, because we're working with local farms and their throughput isn't going to work that way, where I can say, you know, give me 1,000 pounds and I'll buy it all right now. I'm picking up week after week as they're picking them. So what I did is I would just collect it every week at the farmer's market and then take it to our hop freezer, put them into a container and freeze them until storage. So they get frozen over the course of the month. And then from there, I'm going straight into beer and our tank first, purging, and then throwing beer in after that. When they're frozen, I've kind of gotten to a recent practice of letting them warm up a little bit before I bring in the fruit, or sorry, the beer. Not a ton, but just kind of thawing out a little bit, and they kind of decompose a little and will, you know, release a lot of their juices at that point. And then I'll bring the beer in, and like my strawberry beer is still warming up to fermentation right now. And then we'll start doing punch downs as those come. Blueberries, similar practice. Peaches, we haven't worked with peaches in a couple of years, but we're planning on doing it this year. And in Georgia, we've kind of got two seasons. We've got freestone peaches and cleanstone season. Freestones and cleanstones, stone being the pit and free or clean kind of gets self-explanatory, where if you cut up on a peach, if your peach sticks to the pit, that's a clean stone. And if it opens up and the pit pops right out like an avocado, that's a free stone. So we've got some nice heirloom peaches that we've used before called Albertas, and they're a late season peach that tend to be a little richer and juicier, less acidic, and they're free stones. So we will bring them in, and depending on the farming practices, you know, we'll either give them a wash or not. But the peaches we used before, we did. We were storing them for a little bit, so we actually made like a little bit of a lemon juice and water, very diluted solution, just so it was slightly acidic to kind of help clean the skins off, if you will. We did a little dunk in those, and then we put them into large packages that we sucked all the air out of. We did a vacuum pack on those, and so we were able to get them all processed because it took us a few days with the staff we had at that time. And then we brought them all in, and the beer is ready. And then we just aged them in the beer. But that was a couple years ago. So now we've got a little more infrastructure built to support it. And do something similar, though.
Awesome. Well, I think we have, do we have one more beer left, Scott?
We do, yep. Blend number three.
Awesome. Let's get to a quick break. But before we do and have that other beer, I wanted to say thank you to, while we're speaking about fruit, Oregon Fruit Products, aseptic purees that are easy to use and convenient to store with no additives or artificial flavors, simply great expression of the raw fruit. They love working with brewers to help us innovate. Check them out, fruitforbrewing.com, Oregon Fruit. They bring fruit to life. And maybe let's get out on a question.
Sure.
And this question, Scott.
Yes.
And all the questions are going to be brought to us by Dr. Lambic and his team at sourbeerblog.com. Check out the articles on sourbeerblog.com for a great written resource devoted to teaching you how to brew and blend sour beer at home. And now the Sour Beer Blog crew is opening up a new brewery and taproom in central Pennsylvania. Check them out. Mellow Mink Brewing at mellowmink.com.
Right on. So do you guys think you could tackle a spontaneous fermentation question?
Why not?
Okay. This is from Steven out in Bozeman, Montana. Steven writes in, "Hey, Jay in Moscow. I've been listening to the podcast from the beginning, and a few conversations on spontaneous fermentations, in particular those utilizing cool ships, have had me wondering if the reason for primarily brewing spontaneously fermented beers with cool ships during the fall and or winter months has more it being conducive to ambient cooling or the seasonality of the airborne microbiome. I know generally the populations of airborne microbes undergo seasonal changes as those of any other population, but I'm unclear on whether, say, the summer airborne microbiome would be less conducive somehow to bring high-quality spontaneously fermented beer, or are the colder months just more optimal because the cooling rate either matches better with the brewing schedules, or the faster cooling somehow optimizes or discourages the growth of ideal or non-ideal microbes."
Yeah, I'll, you know, not being the most experienced spontaneous brewer, I'd put this answer out there as perhaps correct, which I guess you can take all my answers that way. But I'd say it has more to do with the cooling rate than anything. I think you are going to, if you're mimicking lambic producers, then, you know, they've proven in their climate that they are discouraging bad bacteria, encouraging good bacteria for sour beer production. If we're talking about amount of micro activity, I'd say probably the hottest part of the year has way more micro activity. It just has to come down to the cooling rate. So if you had something like a glycol jacketed cool ship that you could manipulate, arguable whether or not that's spontaneous at that point, right. But you know, perhaps that would produce a different beer. I'm not sure if it would be better or worse, but you might get more micro activity. But I don't know, Blake, what do you think?
I think it's a combination of both. So certainly there's a huge aspect of the fact that you want to cool your wort in a certain amount of time to get to a certain temperature to favor the microbiological activity that you want. And I think generally speaking, in the time of year where it's colder outside, you have a lot less of the shitty bacteria growing. You know, if you think about just kind of disease in general, you hear about, you know, a lot more bacteria outbreaks and things like that happening during the warmer months, I would think. Not to say that it's going to cause diseases, but it just kind of is an anecdotal representation of what's going on out there, where I think you get more yeast that are kind of happy to be complacent and sit around during the colder months. It's funny. We actually did a beer with Gesture King that we put in the cool ship that was a little late in the season. So they actually have a copper piping that will run groundwater through the cool ship overnight. And we use that in our beer we made together. I've heard updates that it's tasting good, but it's only been about a little over a year. And I think we're targeting 2 years before we finish that beer off. So I think you can do it both ways. I know Trevor up at DeGarde, or is it Tillamook, Oregon? He's making spontaneous beers around the clock, or you know, year round. So there's this kind of like yes answer, you're on the right track, but also there's going to be totally driven answers by where you are and what your process is and what's happening, and that's where it kind of gets down to where you're at. But I know when people talk about who have robust, I've sat through a lot of talks, I'm sure you have too, Jay, where you know you got guys like Jason up at Allagash talking about how they're mapping their temperature and what's going on, that there's a lot more success in getting valued flavors out of their wort when they're brewing when it's cold outside.
Cool. Thanks for the question, Steven. Appreciate it, dude.
All right. Should we get to a quick break and then open our final beer?
Yes, please.
All right. We'll be right back on the Sour Hour.
Nico, listen, our lawyers said that we had to do this for 1 hour, and after this, we don't have to talk to each other for 3 more months until the next meeting.
Kids. Come on, let's get out of here.
I'm supposed to have more lines. I'm the professional. Hey, it's Sully.
And I'm Nico.
And we opened the 21st Amendment 10 years ago at 563 2nd Street in San Francisco, just 2 blocks from Giants Park, to make great beer and have a great time doing it.
That's right, because to us, the 21st Amendment is more than just the right to make beer. It's the right to experiment, to be innovative, and just do things differently. And so now, we're putting our craft beer in cans.
That's right, cans. You can find our world-famous Heller High Watermelon Wheat Beer at Brew for Your Die IPA in the Northeast, Northwest, parts of the Midwest, and Alaska in cans and on draft. So next time you're at your local neighborhood pub or good beer store, be sure to ask for 21st Amendment in cans.
Because everyone likes it in the can.
Tasty Crack Cans.
Tasty Crack Cans.
Sour Hour. Blake from Creature Comforts joining us. I want to thank a couple more of our great sponsors. Perhaps while Scott fades this out and gets a beer.
Oh, yeah, sure.
starting with Wine and Hop Shop. Wineandhop.com. Locally owned and operated for over 40 years. Most items are going to ship within 24 hours. To you guys, BN listeners, and you're going to get a flat $8 shipping rate on orders under 25 pounds. Enter BN shipping in the notes field of the shopping cart. The discount is going to be taken off after you check out. And for you Madison, Wisconsin residents, order your homebrew supplies online at wineandhop.com and then pick them up at Working Draft Beer Company, which is located on Wilson Street, right across from Central Park. They're going to waive shipping and give you half off your first beer, and I think you should go try it out because they were very good. So check them out, wineandhop.com. Even if you're visiting Madison, this is Madison residents, but maybe maybe if you're visiting Madison and you want to pick it up, that could be, I don't know, we'll have to double check that.
Yeah, visitors are welcome.
But to get the deal, maybe.
Yeah, you don't have to be a Madison resident.
It says Madison residents. I mean, I'm saying it's Madison residents.
I think it's a specific call out to the locals, but yeah. It is not limited to the locals.
Yeah. Speaking of limited, listen to The Session. And unlimited, listen to Bruce Strong, Dr. Homebrew, Brewing with Style, Bikes and Beers, Heads and Tails, all of the other BN shows that aren't this one. All right. So we've got another beer here.
Yes, we do.
Oh, this is number 3, Subtle Alchemy. And what do we have here, Blake?
So as we were kind of talking about earlier with hops and mixed fermentation, this is a blend that I think about this blend, and I guess the way I think about blending in general, I grew up in playing band in middle school and high school and college, doing marching band, playing drums and, you know, concert band and all that. So I try to think musically, or I naturally do, I guess. And this one, I kind of try to think about how I can express a voice that is familiar based on hop flavors, but doing it with different instruments, and those instruments being like citrus zest, actual hops, fruit, all these different pieces, and create a, like, instead of having a note or a melody, kind of create, you know, chords and big voices where it's you know, creates kind of more of a symphonic kind of presentation. So that was the goal with this one, and part of that is a lot of different beers coming together that either might be very hoppy, like a Brett Pale Ale to begin with, or a mixed firm Saison with like citrus zest in it, or a beer with apricots in it, or things like that. So they all kind of came together, all blended out of wood, and created this beer where it's hitting all the notes where I think like the high end of hop flavor, you get citrus zest, and the low end would be like the funky apricot of stuff, and then trying to present it all as one cohesive flavor.
Yeah, this is another winner here. And I like the way you're describing your approach and comparing it to music. Maybe if you had to, I guess, more on a granular scale, just talk about how you approach blending, maybe just, you know, where you start, what tools do you use, how many people are involved. Could you walk us through your blending process?
Sure, yeah. So it kind of depends on if I'm doing a project like this or a project like, you know, that was kind of always thought to begin and be together. So generally what I'll do, if it's a bottle like Arcadiana that we tasted on the last show, I'll have a set of those barrels with all that beer in it. And I'll, you know, I don't feel obligated to use all of the beer we have from a project in the release of that certain project, because it gives us opportunity to blend those later, you know, and work with, you know, may work with fruit or whatever. So I'll kind of do a quick rundown on the taste, and I'll just taste every barrel, write down kind of what I think that barrel offers, you know, whether it might offer a particular amount of acid or stone fruit flavor, or just be more about the mouthfeel, or more about bitterness, or whatever it may be, and kind of jot down really quickly a note that where I think it stands, and kind of, you know, you can kind of taste it and have a good idea of where you think it is on its timeline of, is this in a good spot? Does it still taste young? Is it taste like it's getting old? You know, how much longer can this sit in a barrel reliably? Things like that. And then I'll use those things to kind of predict what I think is going to be a good blend, as far as trying to have a bright attack to it, which is kind of, you know, the first flavor, having some nice body, and also having some cohesiveness, so it's not just a flabby mess. And once I kind of get those strategies and have kind of my core idea of what I think it's going to be, I'll basically come up with a couple, like 2 or 3 different ideas of what the blend could be. And then I'll use like a micropipette and take equal samples of each one, put into a glass, kind of run through the 3 different glasses. And then knowing those differences in the blend and going back to my notes, I can kind of see how, where I think those key differences are and how they either align or misalign with what I thought they would do. And then I'll come back like a week later, try it again, maybe make some adjustments or whatever based on what I thought the first time. And then after I get a blend that I feel like is really good, I'll kind of shop it around, and just like a really easy litmus test, I'll put it in a glass and walk around the brewery and get people to taste it. And, you know, if depending on how much their eyes light up or they don't, or, you know, they say they taste something that's off in it or not, you know, that will either send me back to the drawing board or give me some confidence to move forward. But that's kind of what I do for those. For the projects that will be different, it's very, very similar, except for I basically will taste all of the different base barrels that I feel like can be a component to the project. Because, I mean, you don't really talk about the other side very often, but you have obligations. You know, you have beer that needs to go into one blend, or it's got to get out of here, or it's going to go bad, and you're trying to reach a certain volume for a blend so it's size enough to where you can release it. You know, you have all these other kind of complications based on what you're doing. And then I'll taste through all those options, and kind of after a couple of times, you know, the first time I may not even do anything, come back a week later, kind of do it again, and it's like, okay, yeah, there's some common threads here, and I could see how these ideas could work together. And that's really largely how the Subtle Alchemy project works, where it's like, okay, I start to see how these can work together, and then I'll come back again and maybe try one barrel and leave out the other one, but generally start to realize how the theme can work. Because if you have an apricot beer and a citrus zest beer and a hoppy beer, you know, they don't always immediately scream that they're going to work together. But then after you start realizing like, oh, these flavors are related, and that may be because I tasted a cocktail or a dish of food or another wine or something, and I was like, okay, yeah, I can see how all these flavors work together in this. Let's go back to the barrels and try that. And then I'll start to blend those and see how I can compose those flavors together to make them all play together. And you know, after I blend them and do the same kind of deal with a micropipette, and it either works or it doesn't. And then if it doesn't, just move on, try something new.
Can I quickly suggest that the Rare Barrel and Creature Comforts do a collab and it be called Bright Attack?
Oh, that's fun.
Is that a term you frequently use, Blake? Bright Attack? I love that.
Yeah, so I used to play the drums, like snare drum and marching band, and the attack is always the first note, and like how you approach it is talked about pretty thoroughly. So I carry that over to flavor. So like when I taste something, the attack to me is the first flavor, and I want it to, you know, I always, it's like telling a story. You got to have a nice beginning, middle, and end, I guess.
Sure. I see. So you're not using it as like assault to the senses. You're using it as like the initial impression.
Yeah, exactly.
I still like the idea, though, of a collab called Bright Attack. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for giving away the name.
I like it.
You're welcome.
Awesome. Blake, when you're, and I'm down for the collab, by the way, but when you're shopping around
on the record,
the kind of blend pre-package, how much do you see it drift from, hey, this is what we blended and, you know, put into the tank versus now, you know, the bottles, you know, you said what might be 6 months into aging. How much does it change in that time?
I mean, that's a really hard question to answer. And I'd be interested to know what you think as well for your beers. But so this beer that you're tasting is bottled January 3rd, I think, 2017. So it's got almost a year and a half on it. And what I think I've noticed most from that beer is from blending it, it kind of had all these flavors that lined up, and then after it, you know, kind of went through its not so great phase and got back to where it was, you know, in the bottle, it takes a few months to get there, and then it's like, okay, this is back to what I imagined it was like before blending. But then I'll notice, even tasting it since then, like, okay, this time the citrus zest is popping, or this time the apricots are a little more, you know, standing out. And it just kind of goes through phases where I feel like there's a different highlight on a different note than before, but I can still pick apart all of the representation, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. I think in the Rare Barrel beers, we see actually a surprising amount of bottle-to-bottle and age consistency. Now, there are certain ingredients that I think fall off with time, but I don't think I've perceived any ingredients getting more pronounced. Maybe save ginger. Ginger has done something that it just kind of transforms into something new. And if you have one of our older ginger beers, which is called Sour Tooth Tiger, and one of our new ones, well, if you have the old one on its own, you're like, wow, this is holding up really well. It's got great ginger character. And then you have the new one, and it's kind of like, oh, wait, no, that's ginger. What's this really old one? It's like, it's some weird transformation that I still really like, but It's just something else.
But if you have it on its own, you know it's ginger. Mm-hmm. Before you actually try what you then go, oh, this is... What was the last... Did you do Sour Tooth in 2017? Or was 16 the last year?
You did 16.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that beer.
I do too.
But...
So... Yeah, in the Subtle Alchemy 3 you're tasting now, what would you say is the strongest flavor?
That's interesting you bring that up, because I really feel like they all go together really well, and that's not dodging the question. It's kind of like before you walked us through the ingredients in the beer, I kind of just, the main thing that popped out to me was good. It's like, this tastes good.
Yeah, the ingredient that we most get is good.
Good tasting.
I get like wine grape in a pronounced fashion from blend number 3 here.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, cool.
I might pick out citrus as number 1. I probably went citrus, hops, and then apricot, but I knew there was something else besides the citrus and hops because it was, I don't know. I guess I'm just familiar with apricot, so
right.
That all made sense. But it's really... well done and balanced together quite well.
Yeah, that's kind of the thing. There really is no like standout flavor because everything is so integrated and yeah, balanced, like you said.
One thing we found is that we'll do some pre-blending and sometimes things will stick out a little bit, and then we blend a base into a tank, whether it has ingredients or not, and it's just better than it was pretty much always in the pre-blend. And then kind of the same thing in the bottle after the fact. Some people might describe it as, you know, certain flavors falling off a little bit, but to me they kind of just land in a safe spot, and you know, we're lucky that that's what happens, but we try to account for it because we know some things will fall a little bit over time and some things will hold a little bit stronger.
It's like all the flavors just kind of get to know each other and learn how to hang out with each other a little bit better. I always kind of think that they're all still there. They just become more cohesive to a certain degree. And I think that's probably why we wait on our bottles so long before we release them, just because I like it to settle into a place where it's like, oh, okay, here's a kind of pure, cohesive idea that doesn't taste like it's a bunch of different pieces, but it's here's this one beer in it, and it's... Hopefully, yeah, we go for nuance pretty often, for better or worse. But yeah, we're going for beers that are very nuanced and drinkable and subtle. I guess next we'll come out with Extreme Alchemy.
Imperial Alchemy, I like it.
Let me mention quickly that the sort of watercolory branding on these 22s is really cool. Did you purposely sort of think you wanted to go a different direction with the way the sort of branding looks on the bigger bottles?
Absolutely, and I would be remiss to not mention we have a staff member named Melissa Merrill who hand paints. She's painted all of the labels you guys have seen on our bottles. She's extremely talented, and for the Subtle Alchemy in particular, I wanted it to just feel different than the rest of our bottles. We charge more for those beers. They take more time, and they aren't going to be made again ever. It's kind of the only example of that beer that we'll ever have. And so as we move through the series, we kind of, she'll come up to me and be like, so what color are you feeling for this one or whatever? And we're starting to collaborate a little bit more on that as we move forward. But I kind of came to the marketing and development team, and with that one in particular, and I was like, let's make this feel like it's wine and change how it feels, you know. And so that's where it landed.
Well, it's really cool, and yeah, she's got a cool touch to her work. And it this is a good spot to mention that guys like Blake and UJ, you guys toil over creating all this exceptional beer, and of course you're looking for a way to package that stuff that is going to let the casual glancer know the blood and sweat that went into this product. Craft Brew Creative will assure that your branding reflects that outstanding craft. You know, mm-hmm. Ryan, the man behind Craft Brew Creative, from his show that you've heard on the spots for his show on this show, Branding Brews. And Ryan is the man when it comes to graphic design and giving your brewery its own, or your brand, I should say, its own voice. Logo design, branding strategy, websites, labels, tap handles. Because of Craft Brew Creative's great relationship with the Brewing Network, Ryan is going to offer you 15% off of your first design or branding project, good for up to $300 in savings. So check them out, craftbrewcreative.com, for details. And if you mention the Brewing Network, let Ryan know that we sent you, and he'll hook you up with those savings. Craftbrewcreative.com. Elevate your craft brand.
Yeah, you don't want to make any mistakes on your branding, like, you know, any. That's what people are going to see when before they drink your beer.
So that's right.
Definitely hit them up. And speaking of mistakes, Scott, let's, you know, Blake has been very generous with his time.
He has.
So let's, and his beer. So thank you for that, Blake. And let's get him out of here on our last and favorite question. Blake, what do you think the biggest mistake in sour beer making is?
Oh, man.
no one's ever prepared. They're always like, oh, my gosh. Oh.
And I totally knew this was coming, too, because, you know, I listen along to the show. You know, the easy thing, obviously, do research. Do read. Do your information. Get out there. That's very important. I think the biggest mistake, assuming that you've done some research and try to educate yourself, is not tasting your beer and being a trained taster and paying attention to flavor. Like, I love tasting things, food, cocktails, beer, wine, you name it, I want to try it, just to kind of put it in the memory bank of how flavors can work together. And if you don't pay attention to what you taste in your life and then not pay attention to what's going on in your beer, like, train your palate and taste your barrels and get to know what they're saying to you, because that's the feedback loop, you know? Taste it before you blend it, taste it before you, you know, while you're brewing it, taste it after you package it, taste it while it's in the bottle, and then just keep trying it and then develop a repertoire so you have an understanding of what's happening. That's the biggest thing, is people not tasting their beer and then getting to the end, they're like, oh, this has got this problem in it. It's like, yeah, I probably could have figured that out a long time ago if you tasted it. So that'd be my biggest thing, is just make sure you taste the beer.
That's a really good suggestion. And you know what? That's something that you can't get from this show. You can't get it from Milk the Funk. You can't get it from reading American sour beers. You got to taste. You got to get out there and have that sensory experience. So that's not something that's on the internet or Instagram or anything like that. So
you just got to experience it.
Yep. Get out there, get that experience, and learn from some of the best, like Creature Comforts. And Blake, so thanks so much for hooking us up with this beer and your knowledge once again.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. It was a lot of fun.
Awesome.
Good, well, man,
I'll have
Blake.
To have you back real soon, just because I like your beer. So
hashtag Rare Barrel Creature Comforts collab.
And what's the name again, Scott?
Bright Attack.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to say.
Yeah, but it's easy
Bright
to taste.
Attack.
It's hard to say, but easy to drink. That could be the sort of like subtitle, you know? Yeah. Yeah, the tagline.
Yeah. Thanks again to Blake.
Thanks, Blake.
Let's take our final break. But before we do, let's thank Neshaminy Creek Brewing.
Yes.
Great beers. They're out in the Philly beer scene. In fact, they're the 3x Philly Beer Scene Magazine Brewer of the Year, 2x GABF Vienna Style Lager Medal winner, Dose Bronze Medals for Smoke Lager, Renovated Tasting Room, variety of beer styles, hoppy beers, sessionable beers, lagers, saisons, sours, free brewer tours on Saturdays, new second location opening sometime before I'm reading this. Check out NeshaminyCreekBrewing.com. Last break.
Yes.
And then we'll get out of here.
Yep.
We'll be right back on the Sour Hour.
When I order a beer, I want my server to know more about it than I do. I want someone who enjoys good beer and loves helping others enjoy it too. I want someone who knows how to pour a perfect pint for every beer style. I want a Cicerone.
The Cicerone Certification Program is creating the type of people who help you enjoy great beer. Home brewers and craft beer lovers know beer is more flavorful and complex than ever, and it takes some serious knowledge to store and serve beer right. Cicerones know beer. There are three levels in the Cicerone Program: Certified Beer Server, Certified Cicerone, and Master Cicerone. Cicerones are truly the sommeliers of beer. The best beer locations have a Certified Cicerone on staff. Relaxed and unpretentious, Cicerone are tested on storing and serving beer, beer styles, flavor and tasting, the brewing process and ingredients, and pairing food with beer. Learn more about your next beer guide at Cicerone.org. Certified Cicerone, because it takes top talent to present a perfect pint.
Back on the Sour Hour. Great couple shows with Blake from Creature Comforts. Great beers. Very thankful for that. Also thankful to be in this beautiful city with beautiful weather we're in right now.
Me too.
Which just happens to be Concord, California.
Yep, and it's beautiful downtown where we're, as you guys well know by this point, located with the Brewing Network's headquarters in the Hop Grenade. And the city of Concord wants you to know, dear brewery hopeful or brewery owner or brew pub starter or whatever, that it's a very welcoming place, Concord, is to start or grow your business. It's the largest city in Contra Costa County. People don't realize how big Concord actually is. Concord is a central location in the Bay Area. We have really strong demographics here, established brewery-friendly community. It's an ideal spot to start or expand your beer-related whatever. It's a historic downtown. The park here is amazing. The downtown is really in a particularly vibrant part of its lifespan. Business parks, industrial parks all over the place. Tons of office workers looking to eat lunches everywhere. The economic development team wants to hear from you. Brian Nunnally, give him a call, 925-671-3018. 925-671-3018. Give Brian a call and talk it over with him. Even if you're just having the beginnings of thoughts. I don't know if I even want to expand, but you know, it's not a hard no. And so I don't know, maybe I'll explore possibilities. Concord's a great place to explore those possibilities. 925-671-3018. That is Brian Nunnally and the city of Concord.
Yeah, you never know until you call and let them know that you heard about it on the Brewing Network.
Yes, that also makes a huge difference. So
thank you so much.
Yes.
All right. That's it. That's all I got.
Okay. We have a little time here left. It all is going to feel like a little bit of a come down after Blake and his insight and beers, but we can do a couple questions maybe.
Let's do it.
All right, here is Lacto question from Jeff Post. Jeff says, "Hi guys, love the show. I just started listening about a year ago after I listened to a bunch of other BN shows, and I had a question." He says, "I am making another sour beer this weekend. I have made a sour before. It was a blueberry sour." He lists the recipe below. I'll go through it in a second. He said, "I made it with a WLP Lacto vial before. I monitored the pH. After about 24 to 36 hours, it got down to 3.5, and I kettle soured it. It turned out great. All my friends loved it. My question is this. I want to make another sour this weekend with the same recipe, but I want to try using unpasteurized Greek yogurt instead. What do you recommend for the starter before pitching?" So here quickly is the recipe. 500 grams of rice hulls. He's got Bohemian Pils. He's got wheat malt, flake rye, flake wheat. And then he pitched WB06 dry wheat beer yeast. And then he used some blueberry extract. He says he soaked the blueberries in vodka for 30 days, and then he blended and pitched after primary. Hmm. Does that all make sense?
Yeah, except when he says he's adding lacto, I'm not sure if he's adding lacto after primary fermentation, but he also mentions kettle souring.
I made a sour beer before, a blueberry sour, and I made it with WLP Lacto Vial before. I think he means the batch before. Monitor the pH. After 24 to 36 hours, it got down to 3.5, and I kettle soured it.
That's where I'm confused, because usually you would kettle sour for a day or two,
right,
and then it would get down. Well, I guess I could answer it.
What do you think about
either way?
Yeah, sure. Let's go with that. What do you think about using unpasteurized Greek yogurt instead of a lacto vial?
Sure. Yeah, do that. And if you want, I don't know the dose rate you're going to want, but if you look up Craft Brewers Conference and kettle souring, you'll find free, just on Google, a PDF from that presentation with our friend Ben Edmonds from Breakside, Sean Burke, formerly of the Commons, who's at a new brewery out in Oregon, and Ben Love from Gigantic. They did, and they're going to do another kettle souring conference at HomebrewCon. Check that out. And I believe, I don't remember which of those brewers used yogurt, but it's like Nancy's organic Greek yogurt, and they used a 48-ounce thing per some BBL number, and that's where you can get your dosing rate. But I don't think you need to make a starter, because I don't think they did. So
there you go. No starter.
Easy peasy.
If you have more details you want to add, Jeff, you can write back in or call in and let us know, and we'd be happy to do a more in-depth discussion. And thank you for writing in the meantime. Here is a humble brag from Chris Humble.
Oh, I like it.
Chris says, I'm sitting on my back porch here in coastal Louisiana, which in summer is like sitting right next to the barbecue pit, sampling a one-year-old rare barrel blonde base fermented with 1318 primary and East Coast East Seine Valley blend secondary. The keg was also dosed with port wine and light toast white oak spirals.
Wow.
I owe this fantastic beer to y'all. Cheers. Chris is the head home brewer at Directional Brewing, and he goes on to list a bunch of rejoiner suggestions.
Oh, great.
And then says, you're welcome. I will work those in a future show during the review segment.
Awesome. So, that sounds like a fantastic beer if you have any more.
You can write scott@thebrewerynetwork.com, and we'll send you a place to send that if you want us to humble brag on your behalf when we taste your awesome beer.
Take some crawfish, too.
Yeah. Yeah. And just, dry ice, crawfish.
Mm-hmm.
Shrimp. Yeah, sure. Thank you for writing, Chris. Here is a message from Joel. Joel Robinson is the founder and owner of Hunter and the Harp Meadery in Australia. Joel says, good day, legends. My question is in relation to furthering the sour education into meads, and if the Sour Hour would be willing to run a show focused on them and how they differ or are similar in process to sour beers. Sour meads are becoming quite a thing in the U.S. Not so much here in Australia yet, but we want to change that. Two U.S. meaderies I can think of are Golden Coast and Caw Point Meadery. That as well as Hunter and the Harp, which is Joel's spot down under, are into experimenting with this style. So some initial questions to maybe wet our whistles. Would the bacteria and or yeast like Lactopedia Brett have a greater chance of growth in the simple sugar media such as honey as opposed to the complex sugars found in wort? Do you have an initial thought on whether that would maybe be true?
I would think it would have a harder time just because no one uses that. No one uses simple sugar to grow. Not to say it wouldn't grow, but then I'd be worried that after the fact, well, I mean, I guess if that's all it's doing, then that doesn't matter.
Maybe it would attenuate further, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's worth checking out for sure.
Sure. Joel goes on. How does buffering with potassium bicarbonate differ from using chalk? Considering honey must is lacking in nutrients, he says we add staggered nutrients with meads, and potassium is beneficial to yeast growth. How does the buffering solution ratio change at all? And are the same yeast stress responses that are found in beer likely to carry over in meads? I recall in a previous show that something like 14 out of 16 off flavors were developed due to stressed yeast. Would the same flavors occur with honey rather than malts? Anyway, he says I have a lot more questions and could talk sour meads all night, but let's see if that's something that spikes our interest. And he says, P.S. if it helps, I could send some sour meads across the pond. Do we want to explore sour mead?
Yeah, that sounds good to me. I am crossing many ponds to come to Australia. Not sure where his meadery is located.
It's for ANHC you're going, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let's see. Hunter and the Harp Mead. New South Wales. Do we know where that is?
No.
No, okay.
So where is it? I'm going
Wales.
To Melbourne. And that's all. And I know Sydney. That's
okay.
It.
Oh gosh. New South Wales is enormous. That doesn't really tell me much. Hunter and the Harp. Come on, dude. Hunter and the Harp. Where's Google Maps? Is failing me.
It's okay. This is great podcasting.
I know. Oh, here. Let's just use this website.
That would be smart.
Yeah, I would just click the link in his email and stop being such a tool. Oh, no. Oh, the link is broken. The link is broken.
We're not allowed to go there.
Okay. Well, in any case, we'll find out exactly where it's located, and then I'll write Joel off the air, and we'll see if we can explore a possible sour mead show.
Yeah. And if you want one of us to try it, you can just send it to wherever I'm going to be in Melbourne in October.
There you go.
So we can do that.
Did we do the CO2 lines, having separate CO2 lines question?
No.
I can't remember. Let's do this one last one.
Sure.
This is from Peter. Peter Kramer says, hey, guys, love the show. I've heard many times that brewers should use separate draft equipment when it comes to serving sour beer to prevent cross-contaminating clean beers, of course. But does this advice extend to the CO2 hookups as well? What are the odds of infecting a CO2 line? Do you advise using a totally separate CO2 tank, lines, connections, etc. when it comes to serving sour beer on draft?
Yeah, it's a pretty good idea. I think there's a chance to cross-contaminate your CO2 lines because if you think about how normal beers are usually carbonated, on average, I would say it's a little lower than draft beers, although you're going to crank your draft system up pretty good to serve them, I bet. I would just worry if the keg of sour beer is higher carbed that the higher initial pressure could actually just shoot beer back into the CO2 line. Hmm. If you keep positive pressure, you should be okay. But yeah, I mean, I don't see any problem with swapping out those lines and keeping them separate. Probably a good idea. Even if you just like split off the lines and they come from the same tank, but it's just way upstream that they're teed off. Mm-hmm. And you can just clean those, you know, like you clean your regular draft lines on a regular basis. I think that'd be fun.
For sure. All right, are we done?
I think we're done, Scott. Super early. Look at this.
Look at this.
I'm not, it's still, you know, we filled the time. But
yeah, well, and you're off
early
to
in the day.
Portland, and I'm off to work as well. So we're, but none of, both of us are just beginning our work excursions on this
That's
particular
true.
Day.
That's true. But thank you for your help today, Scott.
You're welcome,
great
man.
Job.
Have
Thanks
a great
to,
time in Oregon.
Thank you. Thanks to Blake from Creature Comforts.
Thanks, Blake.
For great beer, great info. Thanks to the sponsors, the listeners, and until next time, stay sour. I'm down for the clap, by the way.